This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and from the Back to Back Cafe, a worker-owned collective featuring fair trade, shade-grown, organic coffee, pastries, and vegetarian food. Back to Back Cafe is open Monday through Saturday and is located at 6th and East Burnside. More information at
503-233-1929. I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBLO 90.7 FM in Portland, where it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour, part one of the Monday morning radio zine. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Tammy Dean. The Mole comes to you every week at this time with news and commentary from the Mole's underground perspective. The Mole works out of sight, looking at politics and social movements the mass media prefer to ignore. But like a mole in the manicured gardens of the well-to-do, it pops up where least expected to reveal that there is life below the mass media radar screen. Karl Marx called this old mole the revolution. We have two main topics for today. Bill Resnick is going to discuss some proposals to fix the financing of health care here in Oregon with Mary Beth Healy of Oregonians for Health Security. They'll be talking about a variety of plans, including the one John Kitzhaber is supporting. Later in the show, I'll be joined by Ariel Laudham, one of the authors of a new book and DVD about the empowerment of women in Sierra Leone. And sprinkled through the show, I'll have some short commentaries on several issues, and here's one of them now. What is the primary responsibility of a hospital? To heal the injured and cure the sick, you say? Well, you would be right, unless the hospital is a profit-making business enterprise or dependent on profit-making insurance companies. In that case, the primary responsibility of such hospitals is to make money. In 1999, for example, according to a recent article in the New York Times, doctors in New York City were alarmed by the roughly 2,000 largely avoidable and expensive diabetes-related amputations in New York City each year. So, quoting further from the Times article, the doctors set up centers that featured a new model of treatment. They would be boot camps for diabetics who struggle daily to reduce the sugar levels in their blood. The centers would teach them to check those levels, count calories, and exercise with discipline while undergoing prolonged monitoring by teams of specialists. But 7 years later, even as the number of New Yorkers with type 2 diabetes has nearly doubled, three of the four centers have closed. They did not shut down because they had failed their patients. They closed because they had failed to make money. They were victims of the Byzantine world of American health care, in which the real profit is made not by controlling chronic diseases like diabetes, but by treating their many complications. Insurers, for example, will often refuse to pay $150 for a diabetic to see a podiatrist who can help prevent foot ailments associated with the disease. Nearly all of these insurance companies, however, cover amputations, which typically cost more than $30,000. Patients have trouble securing a reimbursement for a $75 visit to the nutritionist who counsels them on controlling their diabetes. Insurers do not balk, however, at paying $315 for a single session of dialysis, which treats one of the disease's serious complications. Not surprising, as the epidemic of type 2 diabetes has grown, more than 100 dialysis centers have opened in the city. It's almost as though the system encourages people to get sick and then people get paid to treat them, said one doctor. End of quotation from the Times. Just one more example of how capitalism exploits every human need and derails every human art and skill. Our lives are yoked to the wealth of the few instead of serving the well-being of the many. And now, here's the Old Bowl's Bill Resnick to talk about health insurance issues with Mary Beth Healy of Oregonians for Health Security. Bill?
Thanks, Clayton, and we'll have all the answers. Mary Beth Healy, welcome to...
A few.
Well, and a lot of them. Mary Beth Healy is the executive director of Oregonians for Health Security, a coalition that both educates and lobbies for better health care in Oregon, studies the system, examines some of the preposterous ways it allocates money, and calls for different ways of doing it. Mary Beth Healy, a flurry of health proposals surfaced in the last month. Kitzhaber's, Kulongowski's, a lot of them from your groups and Oregon Health Action, from your group, Oregonians for Health Security in Oregon, and the Oregon Health Action Campaign, Mitch Greenlich's. Tell us about why now, but what are they, and what are they responding to? Give us a little sense of the whole set of proposals.
Well, I mean, I think a couple of things. One, I mean, I really think that the crisis has reached the epidemic proportions that have created this confluence of initiatives to address the healthcare crisis. And I also think that many of these measures are in reaction to the legislature not dealing with this issue. You know, we started off in the 2005 legislative session with a whole series of proposals aimed to reduce costs and expand access to health care. And, you know, the Senate passed many of them, the House stymied all of them or watered them down, and so we got some small changes that are all good but not really addressing the main cost drivers in health care. And that's really what we've been trying to focus on, because, you know, there's plenty of money in this system. It's just that the money is not going to direct patient care, and that's what we're trying to redirect some of those resources.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so we have Representative Greenlich and Senator Bates and Senator Westland who have put forward Measure 40, which would declare health care as a basic right, and then put in the hands of the legislature to come up with the plan to create the system. One thing that is both a pro and a con, depending on your perspective, on Measure 40 is that it does stay within the existing system. And I think there's, you know, some good reasons for that. The Measure 11 from Dr. Savino out in the Virginia Garcia Clinic, the AFL-CIO is putting forth a fair share healthcare measure. Senator Morissette down in Eugene is putting forth a prescription drug measure.
What is fair share healthcare? Is the basically the Walmart?
Well, you know, I really don't like to term it the Walmart bill, but the press loves to call it the Walmart bill. So there you go.
Okay,
but basically, it would do
slash at me.
You know, I have no qualms bashing Walmart, frankly. On this issue particularly.
It requires big employers to pay a percent of their health care budget, of their employment costs to...
towards health care. You can do it a number of ways. You know, we actually had a bill in the 03 session that, you know, would have charged an X percent of payroll to provide health care for employees or you pay into a public fund. Because what has been happening around the country is you see these very large profitable corporations that have their employees sucking at the public trough, quite frankly, to get their health care benefits. Now, we want people to get the health care that they need, absolutely. But if you're the largest, most profitable corporation in the United States, you ought to pay for health care for your employees.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least within the current system.
Correct.
It might be a whole lot better, in fact, just to tax all of them and tax rich people and tax all that wealth out there and create a single-payer system that would be universal.
Yeah, yeah. Change the language a little bit, a collective purchasing unit, right, where we can actually negotiate lower prices with these industries. Yeah. I think that's the other thing that's kind of exciting about where America and Oregon in particular is in terms of this healthcare debate today, and that we have a gajillion ideas out there that all will do something, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, we don't quite know yet, right? But all of them are very good ideas to try to address this crisis. And I think that it just gives us all, as Oregonians, a really unique opportunity to come together and figure out what indeed do we want this healthcare system to look like in our state. Mm-hmm. People have been trying for my lifetime to get a national health care plan in this country. And so the dynamics in Washington are not going to allow us to do that for at least another 3 years. So let's work on the state level, build the health care constituency that's needed to address these reforms and cause the change and figure out a system that works and then move it to other states and to the federal government.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Mary Beth Healy of Oregonians for Health Security. Mary Beth Healy, one of the really interesting things is in a lot of areas we're stymied by, in fact, being forced to raise taxes. The educational system in Oregon is, in fact, really being depleted and devastated because rich people don't want to pay taxes and companies don't want to pay taxes, and so we're running out of money and cutting universities and increasing class sizes and cutting all kinds of school programs like the theater and music programs and all of the good, many of the even athletics are being cut, of all things. But in health care, in fact, there's a vast amount of money being spent. And really the question is, and everybody sees it, the question is, what's it being allocated to? Who is it going to? What kinds of services? And also just the vast administrative costs of the insurance companies as well as the hospitals and the huge drug costs that keep going up 10 and 20% every year. With very little benefit to people, huge benefit to the drug companies.
Huge benefit to the drug companies.
Yeah. A lot of the proposals are not to raise more money, but to reallocate money. Is that what Kitzhaber's proposal is about? And certainly the Oregon Healthcare for All Oregon that did ballot measure 23 a couple of years ago, their proposal was there was some changing taxes to replace companies would stop just paying for their own people, but there would be a tax then on the companies, pretty much equivalent to what they had been paying, to fund this universal health, this statewide health care system. What do you make of those plans? Explain them.
Well, Governor Kitzhaber's idea, which is now the Archimedes Project, is an idea to take all of the public money, so Medicare money and Medicaid money, as well as the money that is spent on employers' health care, employer-based health care, and put it in a fund to provide health insurance for everyone, a basic level of care. Some folks find it a little disconcerting on this employer piece, because will employers now totally abrogate their responsibility to provide health insurance for their employees if it's suddenly, you know, like, oh, good, we don't have to deal with this anymore. So figuring out some of those details, I think, is what his job is right now, and how that would work. But his idea is basically, you know, take this money, give everyone a basic level of care. One can still buy up, right? If you want more, you can pay for more privately. But taking all that public money, that is our money, right? We pay those taxes and have that create a basic level of care for everyone.
And how does that differ from Health Care for All Oregon, the ballot measure?
Well, Health Care for All Oregon, that was an 8%, if I remember correctly, and please don't shoot me anyone out there that remembers better than I, but it was assessing an 8% tax, and I believe it was a sliding scale based on income, but that every, you know, it all went into one fund, and it really was a single-payer system. And, you know, that measure went down, you know, by pretty strong numbers.
Yeah. Although they did get 25% of the vote, which is a little bit full.
It is. And, you know, what's interesting about that, I mean, I think, frankly, that they did an exceptional job getting that on the ballot, totally volunteer-driven, wonderful people, smart people on that.
Who are keeping at it.
Yes, and they plan to do something, actually, I think, in 2008. They've been working and talking to others. But I think that, all of these measures just come back to the whole point that, you know, employers, I just got mine last Friday, Bill, 14.5% increase in our premiums. And if I went to go and find the answer to the question, why did our premiums go up? Do you know what my agent will tell me? Well, you know, Mary Beth, you don't have to, you know, cover dependents. You can have employees pay more. You don't have to have vision. You don't have to pay 100% of vision. It's like, wait a minute. That is not the solution. The solution is, you know, giving consumers, excuse me, and healthcare purchasers the power to see where are our healthcare dollars going. You know, if we look at the insurance industry, and I say that only because I did just get my premium increase, and I would like to know the answer why, right? So would an insurance rate review board, which is publicly debated, and have insurance companies actually justify their rate increases? That's one way to go that you really get at the heart of some money in this system that we have today. You know, expanding the prescription drug purchasing pool in Oregon so that we are all negotiating the lowest and best price on pharmaceuticals. You know, you talked about them going up 5, 10, 15%, 20% each year. Since the enactment of the Medicare Modernization Act, pharmaceuticals have gone up 58%. So, you know, we don't even want to get into how our seniors are getting hammered by this bill that was supposed to be a benefit for them. But I think responsibility, transparency, and accountability in the healthcare industry is really what we have to go after before we can go after the longer range reforms.
Mm-hmm. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Mary Beth Healy of Oregonians for Health Security about the health system and the various proposals. To what extent do any of these proposals encourage health systems to, many of the proposals would, and the more radical ones would take that 25% of health dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars a year in the United States, and remove them from the clutches of the insurance companies and this huge apparatus that they've developed, basically to deny care to people, but they pay themselves quite well to do it, and spend the money on patient care in the way Canada does, or the way that even Medicaid does, where administrative costs are very small.
Medicare.
Administration costs are very small. And that money could just be redeployed. And a lot of the, you know, that's sort of the hope of many reformers. The long-term hope. The other part of it, though, seems to me to be to actually push the health system towards quality health care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the great disasters, they keep saying you have the best health care in the world to us. You know, well, of course, we don't live very long. We have high infant mortality. And chronic diseases are treated abominably. And when studies are done about health care, when they, let's say, people really go, experts, people go through the
smarter
records
than
of
you
care. Well, just people who know some area, like diabetic patient care. Mm-hmm. What they find is that most patients are getting terrible care and terrible advice. The system doesn't demand much of the providers, of the physicians or the hospitals to actually be at the sort of, to do adequate and I mean, what's seen as not just not state of the art, but just to do the basics. They often make mistakes. Another thing is, of course, there's 100,000 deaths a year in hospitals.
Right.
That's like a Boeing 747 going down every day and killing people. That is unnecessary deaths, mistakes being made. This tremendous, it seems to me, medical error, actually, and tremendous amount of really just bad medical practice because these people protect themselves so well.
Well,
and is anybody sort of, how do we change the system? Is anybody even talking about that right now?
There was actually. I mean, there's a number of issues around the whole thing around quality. And how do we define quality? What is quality care? But this whole issue that I think that New York Times article was going to is...
that Clayton mentioned earlier.
Yeah, the pay, and there's been some physicians actually in the state who've been very interested in this issue around pay for performance. Because as you rightly put out that, you know, physicians are being paid to treat a disease, not necessarily to prevent or create the system where a physician doesn't necessarily, if I've been diagnosed with diabetes, do I have to see my doctor every time I go to the doctor's office? No. I'm sure there's a nurse or a nurse practitioner that can help to do the follow-up care. Those clinics that Clinton was talking about earlier, that's some ideas that have been circulating around Oregon, actually, to figure out, you know, are there better ways to deliver that care that is less costly, that is more comprehensive, and actually will treat the patient's illness, which is ultimately what we want. You know, Dr. Kitzhaber likes to say, we don't want to talk about health care, we want to talk about health. And how do we, keep our citizens healthy?
Mm-hmm. Now, though, this pay for performance, of course, is sort of in some ways a market-based system. There are other people who wonder whether that can possibly work. What you really have to do is, they argue, is... Because pay for performance would require having a bureaucracy for deciding what is good performance, and ultimately you're going to find yourself just ensnared in the battles over, in all kinds of the struggles by doctors to keep increasing their take. There are other people who say what we have to do is build a culture of real healthcare, and that is create a different kind of relationships in the healthcare system, where these sort of teams of people educate one another, keep one another honest, and are always available for people with health problems so that you don't have to schedule yourself, 6 months in advance to get to talk to somebody. It seems to me there are really different systems of organizing health care, reducing to some extent the sort of the great doctor's authority and creating this kind of these teams of healthcare professionals or people with healthcare capacity in a continuous sort of education and moralizing process.
Well, and I think there's great interest in that particular dynamic, right, where you would have people, teams of healthcare professionals to help one be healthy. But I think that, we are in this place where, everyone, businesses, individuals, governments are all struggling under the weight of the high cost of healthcare. And all of us pay for that. If you're still lucky enough to have private insurance through your employer or retiree benefits, you're paying $1,100 of your premium goes towards paying for the uninsured. That's above and beyond our taxes that pay for healthcare services in this state. So as we look to where the money is and where the money is going, we need to reallocate that to patient care and have accountability and transparency in this system, and then move forward to the larger solutions.
Right. One last issue. Mary Beth Healy, your organization spends a lot of time, including your own, in lobbying the legislature for very important but actually sort of small changes on the on the edge of the system, like having a an agency that would monitor health care costs and make the hospitals and others transparent and force them at least to tell you why are you and where is your money going and why.
Where's my money going?
I mean,
it's
our
money
going. Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, those are all important. And many others. And, you know, expanding the Oregon health plan particularly for children. I mean, there's a lot of really good things that you lobby for and win a little bit of sometimes. But there's also people who really want to see those larger changes in the health system. How do you do both? How do you push for those small reforms, but in ways that are not, you know, by trying to appeal to Republican conservatives, don't in fact legitimate these sort of very conservative ideas?
Well, what I would say very quickly is that, you know, it's building the healthcare constituency, right? And having everyone join together, to fight for their small changes, right? But that is building the constituency that's going to be needed for the broader reforms. I'll go back to the fact that people have been trying to get a national healthcare system in this country for 40 years. And so if we don't join together and address the system and develop ourselves the kind of system that we want, we'll still be doing this circle dance for the next 20 years, and our system actually will collapse before that. Some might say that'll be the best thing. I, on the other hand, say, you know, go to our website, OregoniansForHealthSecurity.org, join us, share your story, and let's move the healthcare debate and the healthcare system and the healthcare reform movement, you know, together. That's the only way to do it.
Mary Beth Healy, thank you very much for talking to us
today.
Thank
you, Bill.
Right.
We just heard Bill Resnick talking with Mary Beth Healy of Oregonians for Health Security here on KBOO's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge. To judge by the conventional wisdom as it is manufactured and disseminated by the corporate media, public services in the U.S. are caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, there is a crying need for increased spending to protect the environment, to maintain public property from national parks to highways and bridges. Public services, including education, health care, libraries, and basic scientific research, are in financial crisis. But on the other hand, the conventional wisdom insists that any politician or party that proposes to raise taxes gives up electability for certain electrocution on the third rail of American politics, no new taxes. Here's an idea that might fly. It comes from Gar Alperovitz, writing in commondreams.org. It's a tax on the wealth, not the income, of the very rich. Wealth, after all, is even more unevenly distributed than income. A mere 1% owns almost half of all such wealth in the United States. According to Alperovitz, many observers have suggested this situation must ultimately be addressed. One proposal is for a 2% tax on wealth. Another is for a general net worth tax. And Hofstra University law professor Leon Friedman has urged a 1% tax on wealth owned by the top 1%. Quoting at greater length from Alperovitz, Kevin Phillips and Jeff Gates have also urged that wealth taxation must now be put on the American agenda. Robert Kuttner adds that a wealth tax is by definition the most progressive way to raise revenue, since it hits only the very pinnacle of the income distribution. Why, even Donald Trump a few years ago proposed a one-time net worth tax of 14.25% on Americans with more than $10 million in assets. After all, such folks benefit much more than the rest of us on from the way the system works. Why shouldn't they pay more for it? Economist Edward Wolff points out that European practice offers a range of practical options, with most imposing a tax between 1 and 2.5%, and all exempting a reasonable amount of wealth for those not among the top groups. One recent estimate is that if the upper range of such taxes were implemented in the United States, they might yield up to $450 billion a year. Now, how could such a plan be made politically viable? The obvious way, says Alperovitz, is to begin at the state level and lay groundwork state by state in a manner that both helps solve state fiscal problems and simultaneously establishes precedents for future national action. This would also, parenthetically, have the advantage of preventing the proceeds from being used to fund the war in Iraq or illegal wiretapping by the federal government. Currently, the only state with a wealth tax, which it calls an intangibles tax, is Florida, along with certain counties in Pennsylvania and Kansas. However, many states have used such taxes in the past, including Connecticut, Georgia, Kentucky, Michigan, North Carolina, Ohio, and West Virginia. There are reasons to believe that taxes which sharply delineate between the vast majority and privileged elites at the top are becoming increasingly viable politically, especially given the fiscal problems facing many states. In November of 2004, for example, California voters overwhelmingly approved tax increases for people making more than $1 million a year and earmarked the proceeds for mental health programs. Even more interesting is a 2006 proposed initiative in California which would tax the top 1%, individuals making more than $400,000 and couples making more than $800,000, and would allocate the revenues to pay for quality preschool for all four-year-olds. State wealth taxes, which also target those at the very top and could benefit up to 97 to 99% of the population, simply take this populist trajectory to the next logical stage. They could be put forward as tax proposals on their own or in a manner which linked the revenue produced to other important programs. Alperovitz points out that we rarely pause to reflect on the fact that for the most part, the only wealth we tax directly in America is real property, in the main, home ownership, the wealth holding that is common to the vast majority. Taxation of real estate, moreover, is based upon the value of the asset in general, not the value of an individual's equity. An owner of a $200,000 home will be taxed on the full value of the asset, even if her actual ownership position, with a mortgage debt of, say, $190,000, is only 1/20th this amount. Meanwhile, we do not tax stocks and bonds directly, which, of course, are the largest piece of wealth. One way to think about wealth taxes is that they are simply a property tax applied to all forms of property, including the kind of property which is heavily concentrated among the elites. There is more than enough wealth in this country to meet the needs of all its people. The question is just how to liberate it from the hands of those few who are sitting on it. I'm Clayton Margaret for the Old Bull Variety Hour. And this is KBOO. Next on the show, we're going to turn to West Africa and the nation of Sierra Leone. Well, this Friday, January 27th, at Portland State, there will be a multimedia event to introduce the new book, Speaking Out, Women, War, and the Global Economy, and its companion documentary DVD, Diamonds, Guns, and Rice, Sierra Leone and the Women's Peace Movement. The lead author of this material is Jan Hocken, a member of our Old Mole Collective, and she will be leading the discussion on Friday evening with Karifa Karoma and Emma Fofana, two local Sierra Leonean activists who served as consultants on both projects. And we'll give you details on this event in a few minutes. But first, here in the studio with me to talk about this project is Ariel Lottam, who's a graduate student in social psychology at Portland State and one of the co-authors of the book, Speaking Out, Women, War, and the Global Economy. Welcome to KBOO, Ariel.
Thank you.
Well, Ariel, this book is a curriculum. That is, it contains lesson plans and along with articles about Sierra Leone and the DVD. Mm-hmm. So how do you see this material actually being used and by whom?
Well, we see it being used at a variety of educational levels, ranging from high school to kind of introductory college courses. It would be good high school material for social studies as well as global studies courses. And then at the college level, Black studies or African studies, psychology, sociology, women's studies. We also see it being used in community education and by peace activists, as well as it's actually very interesting material for the general public to read.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there are many issues that have a wide application that you can kind of approach through this one events in one country.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, what do you see as the kind of central lessons that this curriculum is trying to teach?
Well, I think one of the primary things that this curriculum guide does is it really brings forward the voices of women and highlights their experiences and their perspectives in situations of armed conflict, in this case with the Sierra Leonean Civil War. It also provides a window into the devastating effects of war on women and children, as well as kind of providing space to look at how war can also open up ways for women to start interacting in their communities and in the world in ways that they weren't to before the war, even though they're both victims, and then also how they've been able to grow as a result of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So, why don't we talk a little bit more in detail about the ways in which women's lives were sort of both impacted by the war and how their role has changed? Say around the economy, their participation in the economy of Sierra Leone.
Well, traditionally, Sierra Leonean women have been very active in farming and in agricultural production, but very much on a small scale, and they would normally kind of produce goods and services for community use, for use within the household, and anything that was excess, the men would take to market and sell. Now, since so many men have been killed or displaced or really just aren't able to function in the same ways after the war, women have now been able to move out of the households and are participating in the economy on a more global level than they were before, really going to the markets and also participating politically as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. Maybe we should say for our listeners who might not be aware of it, you know, just how devastating this war was. How long did it go on?
It went on, well, it started about 1990-1991 with a spillover of the Civil War in Liberia. There was a formal end to the Civil War in 1999 with the Lomé Peace Accords, although the special court is prosecuting crimes committed through 2002. Mm-hmm. So about 11 years.
Wow, yeah. And do you know roughly, I mean, is there like a casualty rate? Do we know how many people were killed and how many?
You know, over millions, like displaced, mm-hmm. obviously, hundreds of thousands, a lot of people amputated. One of the signature method of violence of the rebels were amputations, and they would kind of say, do you want a short sleeve or a long sleeve? Would you like your hand amputated, or would you like it amputated up to the wrist? Then, you know, the child abductions, the forced child sexual slavery, kind of taking wives, the child soldiers, that forced recruitment, that were drugged, that were forced, you know, to kill their families, so they really have nowhere to go back to as a method of keeping those children with the rebels. so hundreds of thousands of those as well. It's really devastating. I don't think there's a person in the country that this war hasn't affected.
Right. And so, I mean, I suppose that, the proportion of men who were like physically affected and disabled was greater than that of women.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that, because normally, well, the way that we like to think about war is that these are wars between combatants, and that they kind of stay that way. But that's not the way that war works. And really, the casualties and the way that the villagers, that women and children were really targeted viciously. By many of the sides that were involved in this war, by the rebels. The rebels didn't want them cooperating with the government. The government forces didn't want them cooperating in the rebel with the rebels. And so villagers really got squeezed in between. So many women and children were abducted, were sexually abused, were mutilated, or otherwise abused.
But so at any rate, women were kind of left with the responsibility of holding things together to the extent that they could and picking up the pieces.
Yeah, they were really, really left holding the bag and have really been able to come to the forefront, especially in the peace movements, to bring their communities back together and to bring their country back together.
Right. In fact, the part of the title of the book, Speaking Out, suggests that, and then of the DVD, Women's Peace Movement, suggests that, women really are kind of playing a leading role in political transformation.
Absolutely.
As well as their kind of traditional role, more traditional role perhaps, as storytellers and cultural glue.
Yeah, they do, I think, and that's also one way that the women are going about building peace within their communities, is to making use of their storytelling skills and the storytelling traditions in Sierra Leone to build that fabric back together, to kind of weave the fabric of the communities back together and bring people in contact with each other. They mount skits and they put on these kind of theatrical productions so that people are able to relive the horrors of the war together and create these group and community experiences coming back together and reliving it, and then also being able to move past it and then have some kind of discussion and healing and reconnection between the people.
Right. Maybe we should talk a little bit let's talk then about some details of this political process. And I know that there was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I mean, when you've had so many people, a civil war and people at each other, then establishing peace requires a lot of kind of accommodation and forgiveness. Does it mean forgive and forget? And I mean, how is that working out?
That's a question that a lot of the women in the curriculum guide struggle with, of how do you forgive and forget? And it's something that who do you forgive and forget? When do you forgive and forget? Why do you forgive and forget? The Truth and Reconciliation Commission was something that was mandated by the Lomé Peace Agreement of 1999 and then was created in 2000 as a way for people to be able to fully disclose their stories and their experiences, and also the thing to come clean about what they had done and earn the forgiveness of their other community members. That was in contrast to the special court that was then started in 2002 by the Sierra Leonean government, and the United Nations also wanted that that kind of legal institution in place to punish what they say that who are the worst offenders in the civil war. And the special courts, in punishing people, kind of impeded the ability of some of the people in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to really give full air to what they had done, because then they were afraid that they would then be later punished by the special court. But the question of forgiving and forgetting, some of the women in the guide say, you know, you just have to forget everything. Just forget it ever happened and then move on with the future and come back together and forgive each other. And some of the women were saying, no, you know, we really need to think about why this happened, what are the underlying factors, and then once we're able to understand it, we'll be able to forgive each other, we'll be able to fix these problems and come back together in a better way, maybe even than what we were before. So the curriculum guide really does try to open up these questions for examination, instead of making it kind of a mandate, like forgive and forget and move on, or make that it's not a clear-cut decision. And everyone who's involved in the war is there are some things that they'll probably never be able to forgive and forget, but how do you still move on without being able to forget mm-hmm. these things, and should they forget?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, right. So an alternative would be to memorialize it in a way first and then forgive.
Right. To acknowledge it and to try to understand it as a phenomenon, but not just to try and pretend that it did not ever happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, right. And that must have, I mean, does the curriculum provide ways for making an application of this lesson to local, to America? I mean, it's not just about Sierra Leone, right?
No, and these, you know, the special courts or the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions exist in countries around the world. And so I think that the curriculum guide really introduces these institutions to students in a way that they're able to, that's accessible, that they can understand them and look at different ways of dealing with kind of justice issues or healing issues, that there's not one way. I know in the United States, it seems like we're very justice-oriented, the justice system, the legal system, crime and punishment, but in other places that there's healing that needs to take place on not just that kind of legal level, but also on a community level with people coming back together again and forgiving each other. It's not enough that you serve your time in a detention center or in a jail or are punished in these other ways, but you have to make a real human commitment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, there's one other aspect of this that's in the title, Diamonds, Guns, and Rice, and that's the diamond trade. So could you talk a little bit about the role of the diamond trade in this whole situation?
Sure, and Diamonds, Guns, and Rice is the documentary DVD that is included with the curriculum guide and that is built into the curriculum guide, draws out a lot of the themes introduced in the documentary film, and the lesson plans also make use of that. But it's looking at the diamond industry, and the curriculum guide introduces a lot of the influences that the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission kind of implicate in laying a groundwork for the Sierra Leonean Civil War. And the diamond trade, they don't name it as a causal factor per se, but more of a fueling factor, something that was very attractive in Sierra Leone. You know, they have some of the wealthiest diamond reserves in the world. And so saying that the civil war in Liberia spilled over into Sierra Leone, and that the people who were kind of orchestrating that spillover were really motivated by getting control of the diamond reserves, and that's where the civil war broke out, and that's where it was worse, was in those areas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. Well, maybe while we've still got a couple mm-hmm. minutes, we should talk about Friday night. What's going to happen then, and when and where?
So this Friday night, it's an all-day event from noon until 8 o'clock. It's at Portland State University in the Smith Memorial Union. It is in the Multicultural Center in room 228. There will be documentary screenings at 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and 5 o'clock. When the movie is not playing, we're also running the special features. The curriculum guide is for sale as well. We will also be having a catered African cuisine from 6 to 8 o'clock and a speak out, as you mentioned earlier, led by Jan Hawken, Emma Fofana, and Karifa Karoma, as well as other African immigrants will be telling their stories of their coming to America stories or their stories in Africa.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As well.
Mm-hmm.
There'll also be design elements from the curriculum guide on display, and we'll be having a silent auction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this is all free to the public.
Yes, it's all free and open to the public.
Uh-huh. Great. So that's a great opportunity to learn a lot about a particular set of events in Africa, as mm-hmm. well as ways of making use of that to teach some important lessons for us. Well, we're out of time, so thanks very much for joining us, Ariel. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Okay. Pijama, but you can be dead. You are tuned to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgeridge. Once the elections are over, political issues are mostly about how to regulate human behavior. What practices should be encouraged and by what incentives? What behavior should be discouraged and how? What kinds of laws and what kinds of methods of enforcement will be most effective at getting people to cooperate with the wishes of the lawmakers? But it isn't only governments that regulate our lives. Schools regulate the lives of students and teachers. Businesses dictate to workers as well as to customers. And parents try to control their children. Every form of regulation presupposes a theory of motivation. What is it that moves people? What is it that people most desire and fear? Some ways of managing people assume that what people want most is something they can possess as individuals. Money and consumer goods, power over others, sexual pleasure, and that what they fear most is death, pain, and the loss of wealth and power. This is the carrot and stick theory of motivation. You control people by rewarding them with things they want to have and by threatening them with what they fear. This theory of motivation is the dominant one in our world. It comes naturally to those who govern from above, from a position of privilege, for it is they who have the power to reward and punish. When behavior which challenges entrenched power occurs, the first thought of elites is to go to war, to inflict punishment, to strike terror into the enemy. It is this theory that has produced such successes as peace in Iraq, and an American society free of drugs and crime. Well, there's another theory of motivation, call it the conviviality theory, that can be found in the writings of some psychologists and philosophers. It proposes that what people want most is not so much things they can individually possess, but rather good relations with each other. We all want to matter, to belong in the lives of our companions. To paraphrase Jacques Lacan, other people are important to us not so much because others have what we want, as because the first object of desire is to be recognized by the other. If being valued as a member of the community is what we want, what is it that we fear on this view? Suppose, says Harry Guntrip, another psychoanalyst, we watch human beings at first hand as they struggle with life in and through their dealings with the people around them. And we ask ourselves the simple question, what are people most afraid of? Well, Guntrip's answer is that the one omnipresent fear is the fear of being and appearing weak, inadequate, less of a person than others, or less than equal to the demands of the situation, a failure, the fear of letting oneself down and looking a fool in the face of an unsupportive and even hostile world. End of quote. In other words, what people want most is respect and dignity, and what they fear most is the loss of respect and dignity. To respect people and to accord them dignity is to treat them as equals in decisions affecting their lives. It is to empower them. Every action and policy that disempowers people undermines their dignity, and dignity is no mere luxury. It is what people want most from each other. When it is denied to them by their governments, by foreign invaders, or by their employers, it is resented. And resentment, especially among the young, often provokes violent action. So we see that every system of management that disempowers people is counterproductive. It shoots itself in the foot. It creates the very behavior it is set up to prevent. Why can't governments and employers learn this simple lesson? Because it undermines a fundamental condition of almost all governance in history, and that is class rule. A government or system of management set up to protect a system of privilege, the concentrated wealth of the capitalist class, or American control of the Middle East, such a system can hardly recognize the dignity and equality of those without privilege, those it exploits. Cooperative businesses, those owned by the workers, are more productive than those owned and managed for the benefit of Wall Street. But managers working for Wall Street can hardly put workers in charge of production without making Wall Street redundant. Empowerment of the people means disempowering every concentration of power, the power of capital, and the power of governments that serve entrenched privilege. And that's all from the Old Mole this morning. Bill Resnick talked with Mary Beth Healy from Oregonians for Health Security, and I interviewed Ariel Lottom about the book Speaking Out, Women, War, and the Global Economy, which will also be the topic of a multimedia event on Friday at Portland State in Smith Hall, starting at noon. For more information on that, call Jonah Loeb at 503-810-3085 or write to Jonah, that's email, jonah@pdx.edu. And join us again next Monday morning for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Old Mole's Underground Perspective. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Tammy Dean. And stay tuned now for Health Watch.